The reason it's kind of funny, so the reason he was going in and out is Taylor, our communication guy, is back here messing with it. he's back here messing with it, and he's like, yeah, I'm going in and out. Yeah, okay. He's back here messing. Okay. Anyway, we're going to have fun this weekend for sure. So steps 3, 4, and 5, we got Tara doing, and like I said, it's going to be a great joy. So here's Tara.
Hi, my name's Tara. I'm a recovered drug addict and alcoholic. Hi, it's good to see all you here this morning. I got to say, I'm loving the accents. I'm really loving listening to you guys talking with y'all and all that stuff. I just love it. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come here and share with you this weekend. And I especially want to thank my host, Felicia. She has been an absolute joy. She's selfless beyond measure, and I've really enjoyed getting to know her. So God placed you in my life this weekend for a reason. I've laughed with you. Forget about it. You should be a stand-up comic, man. You're the perfect person to be up here. Anyway, my sobriety date is August 24th, 1986. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. She knows she's my sponsor. I love sponsoring women. It's the greatest joy in my life to be able to pass along the message contained in the big book. I have a service commitment. I absolutely love the program as outlined in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's transformed my life. I'm not going to adequately be able to put into words what this program has done for me, and that's what makes me nervous when I get up here. You know, I'm not nervous that you're going to like me or not like me. I'm not nervous about any of that. I'm nervous about how do I adequately express in words what pages in a book and applying them to my life has done for me and countless others. Like, I just feel like you can't really do it justice, but I'm going to try my best. I said my sober date was August 24th, 1986, so I just celebrated 35 years on Tuesday, and what you need... Thanks. What you need to know about that and about me and my story is... I did not get the gift of desperation until 19 years. So I've only been practicing this as a design for living for 16 out of 35 years. I feel like I can't just jump into step 3 without touching on step 1 and 2 quickly. And my experience was I was under the false belief, number 1, that I had to be an addict and an alcoholic, because who would do the crazy shit I did? So that's what made the consequences and the things I did. I knew I wasn't normal, so I must be, right? That's what I had. That's how I qualified myself. The fellowship is what kept me going for years. I truly believed if I put down drugs and alcohol, I would be okay. Like, that was my problem. That was another misconception. Because I'm the type of person, and I didn't get it in the big book until I went through the big book at 19 years crazy, stone cold crazy, and desperate, that, you know, when people would tell their stories, they'd say, oh, when I had my first drink or I had my first drug, it made me prettier and taller and thinner, and I could talk to boys or I could talk to girls, and I fit in, and none of that happened for me. What happened for me was I got that sense of ease and comfort that came at once from taking the first whatever. For the first time in my life, I felt like I could do me. I was restless, irritable, and discontent from the moment I popped out of the womb. It was never enough. It was never the right kind. I was never happy. Okay? I could show you a picture of me at Christmas. Maybe I was, 7 years old, standing in front of this tree with a dollhouse, a doll that stood as tall as me, a baton, these cool little high heels clipped onto my feety pajamas, a bike with a bell and a basket and a real raccoon tail. And the look on my face was, is this all that there is? I don't know if you can relate to that, but it was just never enough. You know, I was never happy. So that sense of ease and comfort I got at once, you know, drugs and alcohol were the solution to that. I finally felt like I could do me. And I heard a speaker once describe it like this, and I was like, oh, man, that was me. She said, up until the first drink and drug I took, I felt like I was holding my breath my whole life, and I could finally breathe. I can do me now, okay? So my misconception of what being a drug addict and an alcoholic was totally wrong. And for 19 years, I found the fellowship I craved. You know, I was bullied a lot as a kid, like extremely bullied, and didn't have friends, wasn't invited to all the birthday parties or the sleepovers and all that nonsense. None of that made me a drug addict or an alcoholic. But when I came to you and you loved on me, I was like a dry sponge and I just soaked it up. And I lived on the fellowship for 19 years. I loved coming to meetings. I got a commitment. Cleaning out ashtrays was my first commitment. I joined a home group. I got a sponsor. I did 90 and 90. I went on every international convention that came along in Alcoholics Anonymous every 5 years. I worked at a sober nightclub. I went to sober club meds for vacation. I mean, I thought I was a poster child for recovery. I really did. And yet I'm suicidal, you know? Like literally suicidal and going, what's wrong with me? Because I really believe drugs and alcohol were my problem, and I'm not doing drugs and alcohol, and I'm not lonely. I have all these friends, and meanwhile, I want to kill myself, and I have no clue what's wrong with me. So anyway, at 19 years, I get the gift of desperation. And when I say I was suicidal, I'm not like just saying like that was a thought. Like I went to get a loaded gun, and I had it planned. You know what I mean? Like I was really suicidal. So anyway, I get the gift of desperation, and I had heard this woman, Val, speak at a convention, and I asked her for her phone number. She was from Virginia, and I hadn't asked a woman for her phone number in God knows when, and I actually wrote it in the back of my book, and when I was ready to smoke crack, I called her, and she answered the phone on the first ring. And I am literally ugly crying. I'm like, I'm going to smoke crack. My husband had died when my daughter was 9. He drowned. This was 2 years later. And I'm like, my daughter's going to be an orphan. And I'm going to die. If I go out with this guy and smoke crack, I'm going to die. And she's going to be an orphan. And I'm like crying and sobbing. And I'm going to die. Like, I knew I was going to die. And she asked me the most peculiar question. She said, have you ever read the Big Book? I was like... I'm like, didn't you hear me? I have 19 years sober. Of course I've been to Big Book meetings. And she's like, oh, honey, let me rephrase the question. Have you ever followed the specific set of directions as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I am mortified to stand before you and say, at 19 years of going to meetings almost daily, my response was, there's directions in that book? She said, what are you willing to do not to smoke crack? And I said, I'm willing to do anything you tell me, anything. And I know what the gift of desperation feels like. It is a blessing to have that. It is. I know why they call it the gift of desperation, because there is nothing I wouldn't do not to leave this kid an orphan at 11 years old. So she said, I'll tell you what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to get up. I normally get up for work at 7. I'm willing to get up at 6 o'clock every morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, to read that book with you so that you can have an experience with those steps. Are you willing to call me at 6 o'clock in the morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday? Yes, ma'am. She said, I'd like you to get a brand new Big Book so we don't have any preconceived notions and so that you can have an experience. Okay. So here I am the first day. I have a brand new Big Book. I have my blue highlighter to match my blue Big Book, a blue ink pen with a blue notebook. Everything has to match. I have my coffee, my cigarettes. The clock's going tick, tick, tick. And I call her on the dot, not 5:59. I'm going to do this perfect. Like, I literally approach this. I have got to cross every T and dot every I or I'm going to die. And I said to her, I will do this. I will do everything you ask me to do. I will do everything this book says. And if this shit doesn't work, I'm going to every meeting I've ever been to, holding up that book and saying, I did this perfectly and it didn't work. And she said, we got a deal. Because she knew, like I know today. You know, Ebby Promise Bill. You made a promise to him, and I promised my sponsees, if you do this thoroughly and honestly, this will work for you. You know, how many times do we stand at meetings, I hate the chanting, and shake hands and go, keep coming back. It works if you work it. What the hell are we working? I'd been saying that for 19 years, and I didn't even know what I was supposed to be working. You know, but I'm going to be working it, whatever it is. I didn't even know I was supposed to be, you know, working the instructions. So anyhow, she started me on this journey, and here I'm willing to go on any lengths. This is pretty funny, so I'm open to page one, right? Because that's where you start, page one. And I'm willing to do anything. And she says, you got your book? I'm like, yeah. She goes, okay, I want you to open to the title page. I'm like, the title page? There goes my willingness, right, in a hot second. So I open up to the title page, and she reads the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. She goes, that's the very first promise of many in this book. You can recover. That gave me such hope. And that's why I introduced myself as a recovered addict and alcoholic. It's not from any place of ego. It actually says in there, we're supposed to introduce ourselves as one who has recovered. So that's why I do that, because that gave me hope. I can recover, okay? And she took me through all of it. The doctor's opinion probably had the biggest impact on me because I found out what my problem was. And what really, really got to me from the doctor's opinion was, here's this man of science who had devoted his life to working with alcoholics and drug addicts. He loved us. He gave everything he can to help us. And he's saying over and over again, we're beyond human aid. We're beyond human aid. We're beyond human aid. We have to have this spiritual thing. So for a man of science to be saying I had to do that really impacted me. And my problem was, I didn't think I was beyond human aid, obviously, because when it came to them telling me I had to find God, I had to have a higher power, they said God, good orderly direction or group of drunks. So I didn't want anything to do with good orderly direction, so I went with group of drunks. And I made you guys my higher power for 19 years. And then I find out in the doctor's opinion I'm beyond human aid. And you can't help me. You can love on me. You can support me. But you can't fix me. And for 19 years I made a group of drunks my higher power. And for 19 years I'm in and out of being suicidal. I got some hope from that. I finally knew the truth. You can't fix me. My sponsor can't fix me. My therapist can't fix me. I can't fix me. Obviously, after 19 years of trying my best, sober, I couldn't fix me. And somebody had shared that they had done damage in sobriety. I can tell you, I caused more harm to my family and the people who loved me sober than I ever did when I was out there. Because this is a progressive illness, and just because I put down drugs and alcohol, if I don't address the spiritual malady, I'm still getting spiritually sicker and sicker and sicker. Do you want to sit down one-on-one and hear about harm that you can do with double digits in sobriety to the people who love you? I'd be happy to tell you about it. I'm not here to tell my story, but I just want you to know what this woman was dealing with when she got me. So when I find out I'm beyond human aid, there's nobody that can help me, I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. I know my daughter's going to be an orphan, and I'm screwed. And then she says, well, are you willing to believe that there's this power that can help you? You know, Zach did a great job last night. It's like, if you really get step one, you tumble into step two. You just tumble into it. And my experience with all the steps is if you get the step that you're working on, it propels you right into the next one. You know, like sometimes I'll say, what step are you working on? Oh, I've been working on step six for like the past month. I'm like, did you do a step five? Like, because I felt like shit after I did step five. I couldn't wait to do step six and seven, right? So anyway, we get to step three. And now I have to, you know, I have to turn my will and my life over to this God. Well, I get to. I don't have to. I get to. So in the book it says, being convinced we were at step three. And she said, what do you think we need to be convinced of? Well, it's right before it, the A, B's, and C's, right? That I'm an addict and I can't manage my own life. And I have in here, drunk or sober. I can't manage my own life, drunk, high, sober. I proved that for 19 years. I'm intelligent. I'm hardworking. I have good intentions. I have a good heart. I couldn't live up to who I wanted to be, no matter how hard I tried. And believe me, I tried. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. I believe that. From the doctor's opinion and what I read after that, all of step one, I believe that. And that God could and would if he were sought. So now I had to do some seeking. Whew. So it says the first requirement, I love that it's people say there are no musts, only suggestions in the program. Like not only there are 130 something musts probably, but there's a requirement is kind of like a must, right? If it's a requirement, you have to do it. That's another word for must. And we have to be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Man, my life proved that for 19 years. My life on self-will, I'm ready to smoke crack. My parents, everybody I love is in so much pain over the way I'm living my life, sober. So yeah, I was convinced of that. I was totally convinced of that. And then we get to, and I'm not going to go through a lot on this, I just want to touch on a couple of things that were pointed out to me. When we talk about selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, we all know that's the root of our problems and we got to get rid of it. We can't do it. Only God can do it. But what my sponsor pointed out to me that was huge was she said, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. So it's like, not only can I not remove it, she goes, oh, Tara, not only can you not remove it, which I was kind of convinced of at this point, she goes, you can't even reduce it. Like, it's not, you can't even make it a little bit better. It's going to continue to get worse. And so I went into that. She went through line by line the third step prayer with me. I don't know about you guys, but I pretty much memorized the third step prayer right from the get-go. Said it probably a million times before then, but I never understood it. And there was so much that I had. Like, I had everything asked backwards. Like, in the third step promises, it says, he provided what we needed, not what we wanted, but what we needed, if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And my sponsor said to me at that point, she goes, I bet you thought, like, you had this idea that God's supposed to be working for you, right? I was like, well, kind of. You pray, and hopefully he'll... I'm supposed to be working for God. I had everything asked backwards, like everything. Talk about delusional. Like I could not differentiate the true from the false. I had everything asked backwards. So I'm supposed to be working for God. So I'm so grateful that she pointed that out to me before she went through the third step prayer because it made a lot more sense as to why I'm saying this prayer. So God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Well, building with me and doing with me, you know, everybody's like, oh, I got to just let go completely. But this kind of tells me I'm going to be doing this with God and in partnership with God. So he's up here and I'm down here. And he's willing to come here and meet me, but I got to be willing to go up here and meet me. And then we get to do this thing in life together, right? We get to, like, have this relationship with God and do life with God. So I thought that was kind of cool. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Well, I just read for a whole page about, you know, selfishness and self-centeredness and how that screws me up, that I may better do thy will. You know, this is just a quick little thing, like how this selfishness makes sense to me and why I need to be relieved of the bondage of self. It's a stupid little thing, but it makes sense to me. So I worked at a treatment center for a while, and I didn't smoke at the time, but I'd be on the smoking patio, and everybody always needed a lighter, right? So I'd carry a lighter with me. God light. Yeah, right. And I was thinking about it one day, and I'm the type of person that needs backup from a backup. I don't know about you, but I don't always have backup. I have backup for my backup. So I would always, when I was smoking three packs a day, I had two lighters, because what happens if your lighter dies? You don't know in advance it's going to die, right? So I have an extra lighter. So I was thinking one day, somebody says to me, hey, my lighter just died. Can I have a lighter? Can I have a light? And I have two lighters. God would put on my heart, God will always put on my heart, hey, give that guy a lighter. You got two. God's going to always put that there. If I'm selfish and self-centered, I may want to give you a lighter, but what's going to kick in is, but what if my other lighter dies and now I don't have a lighter? So I'm going to, nope, I'm not going to let you know I got another one in my pocket, right? So that's where if God removes that selfishness, now when he puts something on my heart, it's like, here, dude, I got two. Have one. And I get blessed by that, right? I get blessed by that. So I'm asking God to remove my selfishness so that I can do what he's directing me to do. Because if I'm in the way, I'm not going to do it. Even if I hear it, I'm not going to do it. Okay. Take away my difficulties. Boy, I love that one. My whole life was full of difficulties. Well, yeah, take them away because I want to be happy. I want to be good. I don't want to be suicidal. No. So that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So she explained to me that I was entering into a covenant agreement with the God of my understanding, that if he was going to do these things for me, if he was going to restore me to sanity, that I would spend the rest of my life bearing witness to his power, his love, and his way of life. And that's why I'm standing up here today, to give him the glory. Whew. So I'm going to tell you, like when we got to this part, now I'm doing this over the phone, so you can have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps over the phone. I'll tell you that, because I did. And when I was saying this prayer, I was like ugly crying, like I got it. And God, I'm a visual learner, and I don't know if nobody else has shared this with me, but God gives me like visuals to my experiences that I don't forget them and I can experience them in a profound way. And my third step looked like this. I was on a big plane and I was by myself. And the pilot had a heart attack or something. He was slumped over. And the plane is going down. And that signified my life. There was no doubt I was going to die if something didn't change. Like, I'm going to crash and burn. I knew it. And I hear God say to me, Tara, jump out of the plane. So I start looking around for a parachute. I've never had the desire to jump out of a plane by parachute, but I guess if it was going down, I'd be willing. I see, I know people here who have done it. I have a desire to live today, okay? So anyway, so God says, you know, jump out of the plane, Tara. It's going to crash and burn. And I was like, God, there's no parachutes on this plane. And he said, Tara, jump out of the plane. And it was this knowing that either God was going to catch me or he wasn't. But if he didn't, I was going down anyway. So what did I have to lose? It was the most terrifying feeling to let go absolutely. I had given pieces of my life to God in the past, right? Oh, my relationship's in trouble. Oh, God, can you please heal my marriage? Or, you know, my finances are a mess. Oh, God, can you please, you know. Or I'm 100 pounds overweight. Oh, God, can you please help me lose weight? Like, I'd given pieces of myself to God, but I'd never let go absolutely. I'd never abandoned myself completely. And that leap of faith to jump out of the plane and give God all of me was terrifying. But the second, it was almost simultaneously with when I made that decision. I'm shaking. This peace came over me when they say the peace that surpasses all understanding, because I knew in that moment I never had to figure anything out again. I was so exhausted from trying to manage and control my life. And now I knew all I had to do was trust God, seek God, and be obedient to what he asked me to do. And there was such peace in that. Letting go, absolutely. you know, it says somewhere in here that the rest of the steps have to do with how well you take this step. I believe it. I absolutely believe it. People have a spiritual experience at different steps. My biggest one was at step three. My husband said he was set free at step eight when he became willing to knock on doors and make amends. He was set free in step eight. Some people get free in step 12. For me, step three was everything. God became everything that day, and God is still everything to me today. I have a personal, intimate relationship with the God of my understanding. Like, it is so real. I talk to him. I seek him. I still seek him. I seek him every day. He gives me guidance and direction clearly. And if I'm obedient to what he shows me, it always works out for the best. Always. And I'm at the point where I don't need to understand it. I don't need to agree with it because I trust it. And, you know, that all comes down to what's your concept of God. You know, it says before this, you know, he's our principal, we're his agent, the director, all this. As a parent, you know, God the Father made sense to me. I know there are people who don't have a good relationship with their father, and that may be the last thing that's going to work for you. And that's why there's a multitude of ways to find your higher power. But God the Father worked for me because I had this vision of, you know, my kid who, she was raised in the rooms, and for 2 years, you know, she said, I didn't lose one parent, I lost two. I did not handle the time in her life when she needed me the most was when I was the worst. So, but at any rate, I knew what I wanted to be at this point as a parent. And when my kid comes to me, she's 27 and she's rocking and rolling. So she'll come to me when the shit hits the fan and ask for advice, like I would go to God and ask for direction, you know, and I will say, oh, Carly, you definitely want to go left. Definitely don't go right. You definitely want to go, do not even look right, go left. Okay, mama, okay, mama, okay, mama. She goes right because she's my kid. And then she comes back to me when the shit hits the fan, right? And she's crying and she's hurting. Am I sitting there going, you dumbass, I told you to go left. Why didn't you listen to me? When my kid's crying, I'm crying. When I screw up, God's not going, I told you, what's wrong with you? When I'm crying, he's crying because I'm his kid. And it breaks his heart when I'm hurting. The relationship I have with God today didn't just happen when I did that third step prayer. You know? I mean, Ben, I know you, but I don't know you. Right? If I really want to know you, we're going to have to go out and have a few meals together. Talk on the phone, spend time together, get real with each other, get intimate, then we'll know each other. Well, why would I think I could have this personal relationship with God if I'm not willing to spend time with him? Right? I got to spend time with him. And this is how I picture God, my God. So my daughter lives in New York, and she was sleeping over my house in Florida one night, and I hadn't seen her in quite a while, and I'm an early riser. I get up real early, and I've been up for hours, and I'm just sitting there waiting for my kid to get up. I'm just waiting, like I can't wait, and I hear her rustling in the next room, and she comes out, and I'm like, ooh, I can't wait to see her and love on her. I just can't wait to love on her, and she walks past me, goes to the refrigerator, gets some orange juice, ugh. Goes back to the room, shuts the door. And God gave me a visual. And there was God sitting on that couch. And he hears me wrestling in the morning when I get up. And he's like, she's awake. She's awake. Man, I can't wait to spend some time with her. Can't wait to love on her. Do I just go about my day? Or do I take the time to spend time with God? It's a priority in my life, and it's changed everything. It's changed everything. So I take this third step prayer, and I'm sobbing and emotional and ugly crying. And my sponsor said, that was powerful. She said, I could feel that all the way from Virginia. You just had an experience. I'm like, oh, I don't know what just happened, but man, it was intense, and like, it's amazing, and I feel so much peace. And she says, well, you ready for the bad news? And I was like, are you freaking kidding me? She says, you know that power that you just turned your whole life over to, everything? Yeah. You're totally blocked from that power. You don't even have access to that power. I was like, what the hell are you talking about, man? I just jumped out of the plane. She's like, nope, 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 nope. She goes, I want you to picture like your higher power and a PVC pipe, and you're connected. You're connected to that power. You definitely are, but it's blocked. It's totally blocked with resentment and fear and selfishness and self-centeredness and jealousy and all. And she went on, and it's just blocked. And we need to find out what's blocking you so that you can ask God to get rid of it. I'm like, how do I do that? Well, I want to do it right now. Well, I love that it says after the third step, next. Because she didn't have me have this powerful third step experience and say, that was great, have a great day. She got me down to writing right away. Because it says next, and on the next page it says at once. Right? So I was under the misconception for 19 years that a fourth step was about you getting to look in black and white what a piece of shit you've been your whole life. So that you just see it clearly and that you can tell somebody else about it. That's what I thought it was. But now that I knew the purpose was to find out what was blocking me from God, I couldn't get writing fast enough. Now, I wouldn't say in 19 years I'd never attempted a fourth step, because I had. And if anybody's done this and it works for you, God bless you. Like, whatever works. I'm a girl for all about whatever works. If it brings you to God and makes you a better person, good for you. But I had gone on this four-step workshop. I don't know why. Something to do. Everybody else was going. One weekend, and they handed us these sheets with these little check boxes. You know, did it affect your security? Did it affect your self-esteem? Check, 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 check. I checked, check, 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 checked. I walked out of there. I was like, what the hell is that all about? It did not work for me. What my sponsor had me do that was really cool, and I do this with my sponsees, is instead of just checking if it was my self-esteem, she had me write I am sentences. So, for example, I had a resentment against my first husband who cheated on me right before the wedding. It's a legitimate resentment, I would say. And it wasn't a delusional one. It was real. So how did that affect my self-esteem? I had to write these I am sentences. I am not enough. I am ugly. I'm not sexy enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not enough. When you write those sentences over and over and over again, you will feel how resentments affected your self-esteem. I am not worthy to be loved. I don't matter. Right? And that was a thread throughout a lot of them. And then it was, you know, in my ambition, what did I want? What did I want? I wanted him to choose me above all others. That's what I wanted, right? And the difference between the want and the need, my security is, what did I need? I needed to know that I could trust the man I was going to marry. So I'm not writing a book, but writing it out that way totally was a game changer for me. Totally, totally was a game changer for me. Then it also, we had to talk about, oh, this was great. So then we get to the part in the book. I go, oh, we're coming up to what my part is, right? I've got to find out what my part is. And she says, we're done for today. And we were only maybe 15, 20 minutes into our hour. And I go, we're done for today. She goes, yeah, I want you to take the rest of this time to find out where in the big book it talks about your part. I was like, I know it's in there. Well, I love an assignment. Okay. I will report for duty in 2 days at, you know. I could not find it anywhere. And we didn't have, you know, like the apps where you could just Google in the big book, you know, search for. So anyway, I really put a lot of effort into finding that. And so I called her the next time we were going to talk. And she goes, so, what page is that on, you know, your part? I'm like, I couldn't find it. She goes, no. She goes, it never talks about our part. And she says, it talks about where we're to blame. And I literally remember going, like, part, blame, what's the difference? And she could hear my frustration from across the phone. She goes, let me explain it to you like this. She goes, how many times did it say that we're supposed to put out of our minds what they did to us? Right? Lay it aside. Put it out of our minds. Said it like 2 or 3 times. So she said, let me ask you this. She said, do me a favor. She said, draw a pizza pie on a piece of paper right now. 8 slices. So I draw a pizza pie. I'm like, oh, my God, this is getting worse by the minute. Draw the pizza pie. Have my 8 slices. She goes, okay, let's say I want you to shade in 3 pizza slices. And we're going to say your part is 3 of those pizza slices. She goes, look at that piece of pizza. What are you simultaneously saying when you say your part is 3 slices? Their part is 5. Have I laid it aside? Have I put aside what they've done to me? If I'm saying what my part is, I'm still saying you have a part. You don't. This is my inventory, not theirs. So it was little things like this, and this is why I loved, I mean, I've been a voracious reader since I'm a kid. I did not need anybody to read a book to me. But there's something about having a sponsor that points out these little nuances that blew my mind. So now I know, where am I to blame? And then made a list of all my character defects. Okay, so I went through that thoroughly and honestly. You know, I'm not going to get into a whole thing about the 4-step. I flew through it. I mean, I was thorough and honest. I will say this about the 4-step. My sponsor had me anytime before I started writing, she told me to pray and invite God in and have God reveal the truth to me because I'm delusional and I can't differentiate the true from the false still. So she had me pray and invite God in. And then she said, what that does, if you're inviting God in and asking him to show you the truth, if something pops into your head, you can't go, ah, that was 7th grade. I'm over it. Right? So I'm so glad she gave me that direction because I learned more from the 4-step with the resentments that weren't the big ones. It was the little ones. And I can give you an example. Here I am in my 40s, and Mr. Bazarian pops in my head out of the blue. Mr. Bazarian was my high school orchestra teacher. My resentment was I quit orchestra in 12th grade, and he got me kicked out of chorus, and I loved to sing, and I just didn't think that was right. And I have that thought. It's not affecting my life today that I didn't get to sing in chorus, but I heard my sponsor write it down. When I went through and looked at where I was selfish and self-centered and self-seeking, the reason I quit orchestra was because I worked at Woolworth across the street, and I had to be there at a certain time. And orchestra was 8th period, and they changed my hours and wanted me there a half an hour earlier. So I walked in and I quit orchestra. I told myself I'm being responsible because I have a job. But what came out of this was the only reason I quit orchestra was because that job gave me money to buy drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, and put gas in my car. And nothing was going to interfere with that, right? I never went to my boss and said, hey, I'm in orchestra. I have a commitment to the orchestra. I'm first seat. The guy trained me and poured a lot of time and effort into me to get me to be first seat in this orchestra that we competed. I never said, is there any way I could still come in at this time? I never explained to my orchestra. I never took into account the rest of the people in the orchestra, the rest of the other viola players. I never thought of them at all. It was, you're going to interfere with my money, get my drugs. Self-centered and selfish to the extreme. And it was that little thing of Mr. Bazarian that I saw, this is so much worse than I thought it was. Because I knew the big shit I blew up. But I'm like, this is who I am at my core. This is who I've always been. So what happened to me was I finished up all my writing. I said my sponsor was in Virginia. I hopped on a plane. I flew to Virginia to do step five with her. We actually did 5, 6, 7, and 8. And wow, that was amazing. So she invited God in because it's admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being, right? So she said a prayer and she invited God in. And I could tell you, I literally felt the presence of God while we were doing that fifth step. Now, going to do that fifth step, my thought was, I see it all in black and white. I clearly see my character defects. I clearly see where I set the ball rolling. I clearly see it. But I'm going to do it because it says to do it. I really didn't expect to get much out of it, honestly. She invites God in, and we went through my fifth step. And I can only describe it like this. You know how it says with the first step that we have to concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics, right? So I knew up in my head from a pretty young age, I would say in my teens, that I wasn't like most of the other kids. At some point, I started feeling it in my heart because I was hurting people and having regret. And I was like, ugh. But I didn't concede to my innermost self that I was a real alcoholic and drug addict till I understood what that meant. At 19 years, it was like I got punched in the gut. This is going to get progressively worse. There's nothing I can do about it, and I'm going to die. Right? So when I went through my fifth step, it was like I got punched in the gut. I knew I was a thief. I knew I was manipulative. I knew I was a liar. I knew all that stuff already. Up here. And in here, I had some regret. But I got punched in the gut with your best intentions, being sober, this, in black and white, is the absolute best you could pull off. And it hurts so bad. I clearly saw myself, the truth about myself, for the first time. And it was so painful. It was so painful. I had this perception of myself, like my perception was wrong, and it was just like shattered. And I saw the truth, and it was like, here I am in my 40s going, everything I thought about myself was wrong. I blamed people. I ruined relationships, and I set the ball rolling. You know, like I had this huge resentment against my mom. I just thought she hated me, you know, and my son, I have a brother who's 3 years younger than me, you know, my son, he could do no wrong. I just thought she hated me. And then I go back to that picture of that girl standing in front of the tree. And as a mom going through this, how many times did my mom do things for me and it just wasn't enough? How many years did she try and love on me and it wasn't the right kind? You know? My husband once said to me, it's really hard to hug a porcupine, Tara. And my brother, on the other hand, was like, he should be from California. He's just so chill and laid back. And like, dude, you know, whatever. Make anything to make him happy. Nothing bothered him. He was easy to love. I was not easy to love. And I hated this woman and blamed her for so much. And then as a mom, to look at what kind of kid I was. forget about when I started drinking and drugging. Just always. And it was always, I was always not right. I always had that spiritual malady. I was always a difficult person. So it's painful at 40 years old to look at the fact that the reason you don't have a good relationship with your mom is not because she's a dick. It's because you're difficult and you're hard to love and you didn't make it easy. So there was so much regret over all these relationships that were blown up in my life and people I just resented them, and how dare they, and then I set the ball rolling. There's a lot of regret that goes along with that. So it was really, really, really painful. What I want to spend some time talking about is, I call it step 5.5, because I don't know what else to call it. It's after step 5, it's before step 6. But it saved my life. And it's when it talks about spending that hour carefully reviewing. So at this point, I'm going to tell you why I was going to smoke crack and how that hour literally saved my life. I was married to my second husband for 20 years, the father of my daughter. Like I said, he drowned right after our 20th wedding anniversary. We were both 17 years sober. My daughter was 9. I checked out. My daughter crawled in my lap one day and said, I just want to die and go to heaven and be with Daddy. And I could not handle her pain and my pain. So I didn't. I was not emotionally there for my daughter at a time in her life when she needed me the most. And when they said, you won't regret the past, or which is to shut the door on it, I'll regret that till the day I die. I had one chance to do that right, and I blew it. I accept it, but I'll regret it till the day I die. So anyway, at about 2 years after my husband passed away, I have this thought. Somebody said it. That's a dangerous thing, just having the thought that I know what will fix everything. I just need to find a husband and a father for my daughter. Now, I was engaged in high school. I had an engagement ring on my finger in high school. I believe it should be illegal to get married till you're at least 30. I honestly do. I swear, I got married right out of high school. That did not go well. So I was married, divorced, and remarried by 23. How many of you can say that? And married to my husband for, yeah? You get it. So my whole thing was if you kiss me, you had to marry me. So that's how it went. So anyway, I was married for 20 years, and now I want to find a relationship, but I had never dated. Like, I was with a guy from 15, got divorced, and was married within a week. My divorce was final, so I'd never dated in my life. And nobody was even asking me out for a cup of coffee, nothing. And I'm, like, in my 40s. I had bleach blonde hair. I had a personal trainer. I had a six-pack you could see from across the room. I lived at the beach, I'm tan. I look the best I have ever or ever will look my entire life, okay? Nobody's even asked me out for a cup of coffee. So I go to my friend Richie, I'm like, hey Richie, like, is something wrong? Like, it's been 2 years, you know, not even a cup of coffee. He goes, there's something wrong. I'm like, well, please enlighten me. So my husband was a detective. We lived on a barrier reef island, very small barrier reef island, and he was a detective where we lived, and he was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, Tara, the entire police department is watching out for you and Carly. There's not a guy in this whole town with balls big enough to ask you out for a cup of coffee, because if they hurt you, they're going to have to move out of town. So I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So I'm like, well, how the hell am I supposed to meet anybody? Like, everybody here knows me and knows my story. It was all over the news and blah, blah, blah. and I don't go to bars. So somebody recommended, this was a while ago, Match.com. Now, I will tell you, I know there's an awful lot going on with swiping left, swiping right, Tinder fishes. I don't know what the hell all is going on out there. But back in the day, we had Match.com, and I believe eHarmony might have been out, but you had to put in so much information, I couldn't be bothered. So Match.com it was. And I attracted every sicko out there. But I have that low self-esteem, right? Pick me, choose me, want me. I don't even stop to think, do I want you? It's just pick me, choose me, want me. And so part of my regret with my daughter was I was bringing these men home. I was exposing them to my child. I had an 11-year-old who had more sense than her mom saying, Mommy, he scares me. Please don't bring him around anymore. I found out one of the guys was a pedophile. Should have caught up on the red flags that he only wanted to come over when she was home and never wanted to spend time with me when she was in school. And my friends are all watching this going on. I will tell you that the sober woman I am today, if I were put in a position to have an 11-year-old and was even thinking of dating, I would have had the police department run background checks on you. I would have had to know your integrity and know you well before I would have given you the privilege of laying eyes on my child. So here I am sober. Everybody's worried about me, and I'm bringing all these wackadoos home around my kid. And then I met a guy in the rooms. And my daughter actually really liked him. He was a really great guy. Watch what you judge, because you will do it. I was one of these women that really, really, really judged people going after newcomers. Big time. Like, one time I sponsored a stripper, and took a while to get her to dress appropriately. And so we had a break at our meeting, and she was literally like the Pied Piper. The men were just... follow her like a sea of men out the door. And I remember one time at the break, I literally stood like this. And I'm like, you want to get to her, you're going to have to go through me. Her life is on the line here, you pieces of shit. You know, like I was just like, I'd had it. Yet here I am all these years later. And the guy that I'm attracted to, that I'm dating, doesn't even have a year. Actually, I don't even know how many months he had. I think some months. I'm harming my home group. I'm harming him. Oof. But... that being said, he was great. My daughter really liked him. We had a lot of fun. And life was going along great. And then we hit one little hiccup. He started smoking crack again. And now, I have this child who was raised in the rooms literally from a month old. She had never even seen anybody drunk. And I have this guy in my house, smoking crack, cooking crack. My daughter's like, Mommy, what's wrong with Brian? He's acting funny. Word gets to my parents, who have retired in Tucson, that there's a crackhead in my house. My parents call me up one day and say, find us a one-bedroom that takes dogs. We're coming back to New York because they were worried about me and my daughter. But I'm sober. My sponsor, who lived across the street from me, who'd been through everything with me, said, if you don't stop seeing him, I can't sponsor you anymore. I can't watch this. She loved my daughter. My daughter called her Jamma. I was like, see ya. But God. Those are my two favorite words in the Bible. But God. But God. So Brian says to me one day, you know, Ta, I'd never want you to lose your 19 years, but I can't stop thinking about what it would be like if we got high together. And it was on me. Like a cloak. You know when it's on you and you know you're going, you know you're going, you know you're going? It was on me. And I called my best friend who's in Texas, who's been listening to this insanity across the country. I mean, the harm I did to the people I love the most. I said, I'm going to smoke crack with Brian. I just know it. He wants to do it. And, you know, this had been months of being around it. It was a miracle I hadn't done it already. And because she's my best friend, she knows everything. She said, do you still have that woman Val's number? Yeah. She said, call her. Call her. And I did, and that's how my journey started. So God literally used a crackhead named Brian to save my life. Because I got the gift of desperation from that experience. I could have stayed sober another 19 years, and who knows when I would have blown my brains out. But God. So, you know, this relationship with Brian is what brought me to the gift of desperation. And I don't blame my sponsor for trying to get me to stop seeing him, but this is why I don't tell my sponsees what to do, except pray. Because if I would have listened to my sponsor and stopped seeing Brian before he made that statement, I wouldn't be standing up here today. We're not supposed to run. If I can't manage my own life, why would you want me trying to manage yours? Like, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Let's see. I can't manage my own life, so I'm going to let my sponsor manage my life. But wait, she can't manage her life either, because she's having her manage her life. Like, it's so stupid. So I don't tell people what to do, because I don't know what experience I could be robbing them from. Right? She could have robbed me from that experience. And like I said, I know her intentions were from love and the best of places. But thank God for a crackhead named Brian. So we get to step 5.5 after I'm totally deflated and just seeing the truth, not the fantasy I have of who I think I am or the hope of who I want to be, but the truth of who I am apart from God. The truth of who I am trying to live my life apart from a dependence upon God. And it is just horrible. And she reads about going upstairs for the hour and, you know, carefully reviewing everything. And she says, you know, Ta, she goes, I know there's one thing you're probably not going to want to let go of. And we both knew she was talking about Brian. Because I believe that God could get him clean. I knew God could. And Carly and I loved him. And we could just be a happy family. And God could do it. He could do it. So she's like, she didn't say it, but she goes, I know there's one thing that you don't want to let go of. And she goes, I'm here to tell you that I'm going to love you whether you do or not. And I literally felt in my hand, I felt like I was doing a happy dance. Like, I don't have to let go, Brian. She's not going to judge me. She's still going to love me. But she says, it says in here that if there's something you're not willing to let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. There is, when she prayed and invited God in, man, there's not a doubt that he spoke through her exactly what I needed to hear. So I went upstairs to her son's room, and he had an alarm clock, and I looked at the time, because it was going to be 60 minutes, not 59, not a minute over. It was going to be an hour. And I'm reviewing everything carefully, and I'm reading through all my writing, and I'm making sure everything's solid. And I look at the clock, I'm all done, and it's 10-2. 10 minutes left. You know, what am I going to do now? And then I hear her. If there's something we're not willing to let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. And I hit my knees. And man, I cried to God, like out loud. I'm like, God, he's a good man. I know you can get him clean. And Carly really likes him. But if it's not your will, please remove this from me. I'm willing to let go. Take it from me. And what I heard, I told you God speaks to me, is delete all the voicemails. So my husband of 20 years was a very romantic guy. He's the kind of guy who'd bring you home flowers for no reason and draw me pictures and write poetry. And he would leave me these great voicemails, you know, about how much he loved me or how beautiful I am or how am I so lucky to be married to you. And I would delete them all because, you know, your voicemails can get full and there was always going to be another one. So when he drowned, I didn't have one. If you were to ever call me today and my voicemails are full, it's not because I don't listen to them. It's because some of them are so special that I don't want to delete them. And I had voicemails from Brian from before he started smoking crack. And while he was out there running and I didn't know where he was, I'd listen to them and they would give me comfort because I'd remember the sober Brian. So when I said to God, I'm willing to let go, I hear delete the voicemails, Tara. And I picked up my phone, and I didn't even have to listen to him. Hey, Tad, delete. Hey, babe, delete. Delete, delete. And I let go. I honestly, honestly believe if it wasn't for step 5.5, if it wasn't for taking that direction, I could have seen all that. I could have had an amazing 3rd, 4th, 5th step experience. But if I wasn't willing to let go of Brian, I would have went back and I probably would have smoked crack. That hour is so crucial for me. It changed everything. I was set free. I was able to see Brian, have love for Brian in my heart, wish him well. He's sober now, I think, I'm pretty sure. I see him on Facebook. You know, I know when, you know, you can always tell when somebody's sober and when they're not on Facebook, right? I think he's doing well, but at any rate, God relieved me of that. God removed the things in the next steps that were blocking me. And I can't adequately put into words, like, if you don't have this intimate relationship with a God of your understanding, I'm like begging you to seek it out. You know, he comes to all who seek him. It's not about the finding either. It's about the seeking. You know, that's why I love step 11. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. No matter how full I feel, no matter how loved I feel by God, no matter how much, it can get better, and it will get better if I keep seeking. So I know it sounds scary to let go absolutely. I know it sounds scary to jump out of the plane without a parachute. I know, like, fearlessly looking at ourselves all sounds scary. But what's on the other side of it, the freedom that's on the other side of it, a new freedom, a new happiness, if you haven't experienced that for yourself, give it a try. What do you have to lose? And you have everything to gain, you know? God just loves me so much more than I deserve. I mean, it's total grace and mercy. You know, the way I lived my life, the way I treated people, yet he loved me anyway. There are things I prayed and prayed and prayed for that I'm so grateful I didn't get. You know, he just loves us so much, like more than we can even comprehend. And I will tell you this. I had people loving on me my whole life. My family, you know, that husband that I told you about that wrote me love letters and all that, it never got in because I didn't think I deserved it. I didn't think I was worthy of it. He could tell me a million times, you're beautiful. Well, I got told I was ugly every day and being bullied as a kid, and I never saw myself. It didn't matter. Like, none of it could get in. But yet you tell me you're a piece of shit, it'll stick to me like Velcro. You tell me you're ugly, it'll stick to me like Velcro, right? Anything negative, but anything good could not get in because I didn't think I deserved it and I couldn't experience it. Once I experienced this awesome love of God, I was able to experience all other kinds of love. And it gets in. It gets in. So we get to clear away all this stuff so that God can come into us and out of us, into us and out of us. And my only hope is that some of God came out of me today. Thank you.
Wow. Man. Thank you so much. That was so good. And I got hope for a crackhead named Ben. And I was wondering, I was like, I bet all my exes say that shit too. Yeah, I was like, but.